So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Well, a lot has happened in the past several days, and it's kind of confusing, but let's deal with what isn't confusing. You remember the 51 intelligence officers, the senior high-ranking masters of the deep state, who signed that letter, the Joe Biden campaign letter, saying that the Hunter Biden laptop was nothing but Russian disinformation, and MSNBC and a lot of the other chattering chimps of the media ran with it, and they clapped their hands or cymbals like as they're wont to do. But you know what? We've got a guy today. The one guy who did not sign that letter, the fellow who did not say it was Russian disinformation. And how do I know this? He's my brother, Nicholas Cass, longtime State Department official, diplomat, and former Central Intelligence officer and an analyst. Nick, welcome to the Chicago Way.
Hi, John. Hi, Jeff. It's good to be back, guys. How are you out there?
Good. Great to have you, Nick. How are things in Romania, right?
Yeah, little cold and snowy. I saw that there were people putting up their dib spots, so there is dibs.
Oh, man.
Although they don't have a, best I can tell yet, they don't have a neat team term for it. So they just say, you know, it's the thing that when you dig out your spot, you get to keep it and you put things in front of it. So
they're saying dibs is international.
Wait a second. Dibs. What kind of things? Like blue virgins like they do in Chicago?
No, I think it's more just like whatever random stuff you can find, trashy stuff that just
like
does the
tables and chairs and things.
Yeah, and broken boxes or whatever. You know, nothing that could be valuable. They like to hang on to that stuff. So, and then if you're from outside and you see a spot, the proper etiquette is to leave your phone number on your dashboard. So that someone can call you and tell them, hey, you're in my spot, and then you're supposed to come and move. So they do have some civilized rules here about it.
I love it. We got to figure out how we can translate this, John. You got to be in control of this thing. You're the Judge Dibbs himself.
Yeah, I know I'm Judge Dibbs, even despite all the Marxist imposters.
I think the thing is there has to be, and if I may, there has to be regional variations in any dibs. So, for example, when my friend was telling me that, you know, they have dibs, and I said, well, what if someone parks in your space? What do you do? And they said, basically, there's nothing you can do. And I said, what, you mean people won't let the air out of their tires or anything like that? She said, no,
right,
not at all. So yeah. I think there are.
What about freeze their car? Go. What about run a hose on top of their car until it turns into a block
that'd
of
be,
ice?
That'd be a good one.
Hey, nature, hey, global warming's a bitch.
Yeah. Well, we have to, Nick, you have to get us photographs and send them to the Chicago Way and we'll put
them
up. I
will. I think, unfortunately, it seems like it's melted pretty quickly today. It was that icy snow that was on every tree, transformed the whole place into a winter wonderland, but now it's all gone and it's mud. So, you know, we'll see another one.
No, I don't want to have to go and find some random Romanian who will come up to me and say, no, I'm driver. And I want, you know, I don't want that guy. I want you to find the picture.
Yeah, but you should ask your
with your phone.
Yeah, You should. I'll do my best, but you should ask your Romanian and Bulgarian listeners. Maybe there are people in Bulgaria who do the same thing, and ask them to see if they have any good stories about it. You know,
I'd love to hear from anyone in Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, anywhere in the Baltic, the civilized Baltic lands, to tell me about dibs. Okay.
That's some foreign policy.
Now, can we get to the geopolitical issue?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. So Nick, I'm looking at Margot Cleveland, who's one of my favorite writers. She's writing for the Federalist. She says there's only one explanation for Hunter Biden's simple indictment taking so long: 2020 election interference. Her argument is that this is since the deep state came up with its brilliant or not so brilliant attempt to derail the Hunter Biden investigation. Here's how it starts: the charges are so straightforward and stale, it is incomprehensible they were not brought against Hunter Biden in 2019 or early 2020. But of course we know why they weren't.
Well, and it sounds as though they also allowed a lot of things to fall by the wayside on this indictment. I was reading something, I think Molly Hemingway or somebody pointed out that there's, and maybe it was Margot Cleveland, I don't know, but it was about pointing out how there was nothing in here in the indictment about FARA violations and all of those sorts of things,
yes, which
one would expect would be part and parcel with that, because that's the thing that obviously potentially implicates others beyond the business, the scope of business, the normal commercial business. And so clearly there's an example of, they're sort of stuck with having to indict him, but they're still trying to protect the boss. The sad thing is they have so politicized it that it's almost impossible, I think, for anybody to take at face value anything that comes up these days. And it's just the damage has been so, so dramatic. And these idiots don't really understand what they've done, or maybe they just don't care. But the damage has been incalculable. And it's really, really a sad thing to see. But seeing it on so many different fronts. Yeah.
So what damage has been done?
Well, I mean, if put it this way, if you're talking about prosecutorial inaction or omission because of in order to favor a particular candidate or particular party, then of course you create the impression that justice is one-sided. And that comes, again, it's bad enough if it looks like that just in the isolation, but this comes against the backdrop not only of this and the failures of the Hunter Biden thing in 2020 and all through, but the indictment, the impeachment of President Trump on two counts, on two impeachments, the indictment of President Trump, and of course the deep state operation against President Trump when he was in office, the effort to try to claim that he was a Russian spy, etc. I mean, these are all part of the thing that create lack of trust in the system. So I think it's the damage has been done. And that's very, very foreboding to me.
Now, you worked for years in CIA and then in Department of State.
Yeah.
People should know that you didn't come there with a silver spoon Yale degree. You didn't show up as Bill Buckley's nephew.
Right.
You're just the son of a Greek butcher like me.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of all the young people that have spent their lives in CIA and State Department, young analysts. How does this affect them? How does this affect the culture when they see the thing falling apart? Do they make decisions, like political decisions, that wouldn't have been made years ago? Like, what team am I on? How do I go to win?
Well, I think I can comment about this in the context of a broad swath of the federal bureaucracy generally, because I think the same, what you're seeing in any particular bureaucracy is the same as others, the same as in media, it's the same as in academia, okay? And there will be two different classes of people. There will be the kinds of people who will try to serve and do their job and put their heads down and work and are not inclined to rebellion, which is what you want. You don't want a civil service or government bureaucracy to feel entitled to turn the kettle drums over and march into the Atmedan and rebelled against the Sultan. You don't want that, okay? You want them to restrain themselves because they're there at the behest or at the leave of the duly elected people in this country, okay? So you don't want that as a general rule. But so you have that. You have a lot of, I think, professionals who are just trying to do their job. You have other people who are careerists who sense what's important and what's driving the possibility for promotion, and that includes people who are glomming onto DEI stuff or woke stuff because they think of that as a ticket to advancement and right. All of that. And you see that in the media, you see that in academia. And of course, all of that distorts, I mean, in many ways, it's corrupts, American discourse, it corrupts American society on a very basic level. We're a country of people who traditionally have tried to stand on their own feet, and now we're playing courtier games, back in the back rooms constantly. So I think that's kind of a very, very sad turn of events. But also it gets back to the thing we've talked about almost consistently for the last couple of years, which is how do you perceive reality? How do you know what you know? How do you understand events on the ground outside of that prism? Because that prism doesn't correspond to the realities that you see. And you're seeing, unfortunately, that play out in a variety of big ways, not only at home, but internationally. And these things have, there's a feedback loop. I mean, what happens abroad now is starting to affect our own perceptions of what we're doing. We're trying to cobble together world visions that satisfy domestic constituents and then apply those to foreign policy crises in ways that are completely inappropriate. And you're seeing it play out. We saw it play out, for example, in Afghanistan for many, many years. You saw the failure of Afghanistan and the lies that were being told right up to the very end of the pullout and how extraordinarily inept it was. I was having lunch with a very senior political figure here not too long ago, very, very senior. And he's like, I just can't get it. I don't understand. What were you guys thinking? How could you do this? And it creates the impression that, correctly, that we don't know what we're doing. And then you apply that to Ukraine, where the media willfully and others willfully lied about the situation long enough to get hundreds of thousands of people killed when it was clear from the beginning that this was a problem. You know, I look back at our first podcast that we did back in February of 22, before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, this is not going to end the way America wants it, with whatever our priorities are. It's not going to end that way. And that we had shared great concern about whether or not we would be able to execute this in any case. And what we've seen, of course, is that playing out exactly over time. And now it's in free fall with potential rebellion in Congress. To the point where, they're not going to be sending the money on. And, of course, now the political masters and the bureaucratic masters are using extraordinarily over-inflated rhetoric about fighting the Russians directly and the Russian attack on NATO. I mean, this is just absolutely dangerous and stupid. It's ludicrous. Well,
speaking of stupid, I've heard that there, and I'm accused often, not by Jeff, because he knows by others, the others that, well, I'm always for the Republicans, whatever they say, I chatter like a fool for the Republicans. No, not. Mm-hmm. And they broke me from loving them in the first Iraq war when they destroyed the Middle East. Right. And I supported it and never again. And now, what am I seeing with stupidity from Lindsey Graham?
Well, of course.
What is going on with that?
You mean in terms of Ukraine or the Middle East?
Ukraine, the Middle East, all the babbling his mouth.
These guys, and I think, Nikki Haley as a candidate for president is the perfect weather vane for that. I mean, she has barely enough understanding of these issues to get down a few talking points. And then, you know, I mean, I would hate to actually sit down and question her more fully on this because I think it would be just
because you need a woman.
But you know what? But that kind of politics, that's so 2000, you know, that's so old. Kid, I don't think young voters in particular care about that stuff anymore. That's right. That's like so dumb. And so what I worry about is the same disinformation, pardon my French, that the NATO governments and the West media and everybody else shoved down everyone's throats on Ukraine, needlessly clouding the issue, keeping people from seeing what was going on, giving them free rein thereby to continue to follow an insane policy that was actually harmful to NATO interests. And now I'm happy to go into that if you'd like.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it now in the Middle East as well. And it's really a tragedy because the fight, it's almost like, you know, you throw a stone in among the soldiers of the dragon's teeth and they start to fight each other, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's going on. There are, of course, charges and accurate criticisms of some of the way in which people have debated this issue and talked about this, and these protests, which have featured, you know, anti-Semitic language, you know, kill the Jews and this kind of thing. This coming after Hamas attacked and killed 1,400 or 1,200 people on October 7th in a horrific sort of situation. But the challenge is trying to find the difference between what the extremes want. And in the context of the debate here in the United States and elsewhere, it seems to me that extremes on both sides want Hamas and the Palestinians to be identically one and the same. The Hamas certainly wants that. They want no daylight between themselves and the perception of the Palestinian cause. And of course, I think the most extreme elements in the government of Israel are saying the same thing. And if you look at some of the comments that people have made from President Herzog in October about how, you know, Palestinians, you know, the entire nation is responsible, and, you know, the finance minister talking about promoting voluntary, quote unquote, migration into regional areas. These start to and coupling that with the absolutely horrific damage done to the civilian population and infrastructure in Gaza, it's just a fact that you can get these things. It makes it harder and harder for people to talk about what the effect of this is and what to do. And so, for example, the Republican Congress passed a resolution saying that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And I'm sorry, but there are a lot of people who dispute that, Christians and others in the Middle East who don't share that for a variety of reasons. And there are other people who would analogize that to sort of like Zionism as a species or the kind of reflection of the same forces that led to secular Kemalism, which, you know, imposed a secular ideology on the Turkish state that was completely inappropriate to the realities. But the point is not to determine whether or not this is right or this is wrong. The point is to determine how people think about this and what can be done. And if we're stuck talking within the categories that are deemed acceptable in American political discourse, all right, then we're not going to be able to get to the root of this, because there is really no alternative than to try to find some daylight between what Palestinian aspirations are and what the aspirations of Hamas are. There have to be some. Netanyahu talked about, in Israel, talked about wanting to de-radicalize Hamas. Okay, you can't do that if you kill 15,000 civilians. I mean, can you imagine what those kids are, the survivors are going to do when they grow up? So it's not even a question of whether or not one, you know, thinks this is right or thinks this is wrong. You know, in the case of the United States, of course, any kind of incitement to violence is a crime and should be stopped, and that people should pay the price for inciting violence. And if someone's out there making
or for trapping Jewish students in the library and pounding on the windows.
Anything, anything like
that. Although apparently the Ivy League presidents did find any concern. They said it's all about context.
Well, they should have said, real simply, like some of them have since tried to correct this,
right,
that anybody who talks about wanting to commit a genocide against innocent people, or against any people for that matter.
In general, genocide is bad.
That's an incitement to violence, and we've had enough of that. We can't allow that stuff to happen. At the same time, and we just went through it with Ukraine, you cannot be in a situation where if you question what the government is doing, you are then deemed to be a Putin sympathizer, right? We went through 7 years of that crap.
Right.
Yeah, because anytime Jeff and I would say something like, do we really want to go, are we really trying to go to war with Putin? We'd get hit with, Cass, Carlin, you're a bunch of Putin lovers.
Putin's a bad dude in my book.
Right,
exactly. Exactly. And the problem is, if you're not allowed to think and talk in terms other than the pre-chosen delineation of acceptable discourse that's being foisted upon us on any issue, then you're doomed to failure. Well,
part of that, I think, Nick, is that the universities that we're talking about, they have taken millions upon millions, tens of millions of dollars, maybe billions, from the Middle East, from Qatar, from other places, the Saudis, to establish their Middle Eastern centers for study. And in the old days, when it was a bunch of tweedy English aristocrats, they were denounced as Arabists, and they had to separate themselves. But now, apparently, it's okay for Qatar and Saudis to dictate the academic pursuits of elite universities.
Well, it's... anytime you have any kind of institution like that, you gotta see where the money comes from, and that's what basically will drive so much of the opinion. You can find outliers, I think, but whether it's an academic institution, a think tank, whether brought to you by Raytheon, anything.
Okay, let's get to it.
Right.
Nikki Haley is one of the chief offenders, in my view.
Right.
Things you can't say or think about.
Right.
And the cheapest one is, if you criticize me, I'm a woman, and so you hate women.
Right.
But
which is ludicrous, and I don't think it's going to work.
But she's a neocon who's part of that whole George Bush neocon movement, Dick Cheney, all that stuff.
Right. Exactly.
And I don't like that. I'm sorry. I don't.
Right. And so what they're trying to do is, I think, that a lot of money is coming into her, both from the Democratic donors and Republicans, because they want to return the Republican Party to, the party of Bill Cellini in Illinois.
Yeah.
They want to turn it. That's exactly what they want. They want the Washington Generals. Okay. They don't want it to compete with the Harlem Globetrotters. They want it to, like, where's my cut? You know, did I sing? Okay. You know, we're going to all work at the same ends, which don't reflect the realities. And so, as a matter of principle, if you start to restrict people's ability to think, then we're going to run into big, big trouble. And that applies to the way in which the neoconservatives and the liberal internationalists have talked about the international rules-based order and the things we should do. For example, right now, the unfortunate challenge for Israel is, how do you smash Hamas without doing damage to your long-term strategic equities? And as you know, we talked about that. I wrote about that for your website and in an article called Heading to Disaster. Well, if you look back on that now, that was written in late October. I think it was published in early November. Here we are in toward mid-December. And I think it's become that disaster. It's become such a disaster that the strategic equities of Israel and of the United States are being permanently damaged by the way in which Israel is going about this issue. They're not doing it with intelligence operations. They're not fighting house to house. They're blowing down buildings, and they, by their own admission, they're saying, we're looking for maximum destruction. It's got so bad that even the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, who is otherwise spouting nonsense about Ukraine, is saying that, you know, obviously in the case of Gaza, the Israelis are staring at a strategic defeat, because if they can't separate the Gaza population from the perpetrators of the attack, they're going to destroy their long-term prospects. But it's not just Israel. It's the United States. And so I asked the other day, I said, okay, what are we doing about it? How are we affecting this policy? Now, it could be that the United States is quietly having demonstrated its support for Israel. And I think Biden has demonstrated that very, very strongly, that he was willing to support Israel through thick and thin. So I don't think that that's an issue. I think that's an issue for the Republicans, who are now trying to outpace that in a way that leads them to do things like the ill-advised congressional resolution that I talked about. But and I know Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, who, you know, I worked very closely with for a couple of years at the White House many years ago, the Clinton administration. He said something about how, you know, the actual activities of Israel seem to contradict their intent, meaning that they understand the need to separate, distinguish between the population and Hamas. And they intend to do so, he suggested, but that the activities that they've been conducting sort of fly in the face of that. I mean, this is gentle language, but is essentially diplomatic screaming, grabbing the lapels and screaming in the face. Okay. But the question is, what are you going to do about it? Because if all you do is say this and you continue to go off the cliff, you're still going off the cliff. And right now, throughout the Middle East, you know, it's undercutting our ability to be seen as being able to manage the situation on the Arab street in particular, but also in a place like Turkey, where Erdogan's saying, you know, we could have a peaceful region if it weren't for the United States. Why is he saying that? Well, it's based that on precisely the dynamic I talked about in the article,
right,
which is they look at the United States as the primary source of instability in the region and as a destructive force. Everyone does that now. This has only underscored that. And when you think about from the perspective of what we're fighting in Ukraine for, we're supposed to be fighting in Ukraine for the internet, the survivability of the international rules-based rational liberal order, whatever, right? Uh-huh. Well, you know, in order to pursue that, we've done a lot of things, like destroy Serbia when Milosevic with ethnic cleansing. We've mm-hmm. we've done a whole host of things where we've clearly made our...
We bombed the Serbian Orthodox in their churches on Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
And Clinton pretended it was like no big deal. It's just, you know, it was a big deal.
Yeah. So my point is, if you're doing this, okay, in some cases and not in others, what are the criteria by which you're making these distinctions? And the sad fact of international perception here is that, you know, what the Israelis doing, the Israel is doing with respect to innocent civilians in Gaza is horrific. And now a lot of people are throwing around words. I'm not going to, you know, define this as a legal term. I can only say this, that, you know, I spent a lot of time in Kurdistan back in, you know, still to this day, but also including back in the early 90s. And that was at a time when people were trying to focus on what happened to the Kurds under Saddam, the Anfal campaign, which, you know, where they gassed them and did all this stuff. Yeah. And, it was very, very difficult to prove, you know, the Kurds would say this is a genocide, right? But it was very, very difficult to prove genocide, even with all the documents that had been discovered, et cetera, over the course of time, right? Because it's a very difficult and high standard to prove this kind of intent. And that's a good thing, because with the expansion of the term genocide beyond what one would think, which is like the extermination of a people, now it's sort of become a little bit more of a broad term that can be applied to horrific events generally, but perhaps don't rise to the level of what we saw in Nazi Germany, right? So the intent element is of a pretty high standard. Now, a couple of guys in Kurdistan did get convicted. Chemical Ali, you remember him?
Right.
Right, and those guys, and they got charged with these kind of crimes, et cetera. So the Kurds for their perspective, the Kurds of northern Iraq say there was a genocide. The Hague said that genocide, as I understand it, that the genocide was not there was not sufficient evidence to do that. Now, I may be wrong, so forgive me, but what my only point here in talking about this is to demonstrate the difficulties of these of the use of this language. I won't use that language. I don't want to use that language. Right. And the reason why is I'm not trying to avoid it because I think, you know, yes or no, blah, 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 but because it doesn't really matter what I think. What I think is that there are a lot of civilians being killed, and that, as Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, said, this is presenting a strategic defeat for Israel and the United States. And in the rest of the Middle East, regardless of what we think, they think it's the worst possible thing. Okay? And that is a political reality that we now have to deal with. If we talk to these folks or these people who believe this, and we say, well, you know, we made a careful legal determination distinguishing between, you know, combatants and innocent civilians. And yes, this happened and innocent civilians were killed, but it wasn't because we were targeting, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Which is what you do in any state, in the United States in particular, when you're engaging in this kind of activity, because you have to have some sort of legal basis upon which to justify your activity, right? Mm. So, you know, we have these debates and this sort of analysis any country does about, you know, what they're doing, what their targeting is, who they're hitting, what's the risk of collateral damage, et cetera, et cetera. All of that can be done to protect the institutions of the state from any legal recourse. And that's an important thing. People have to have that, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. It's, again, deserves got nothing to do with it. It doesn't matter in terms of what people think, whether or not you were killed as a direct, as a target, or whether, you know, your family was wiped out because it was collateral damage. You think some of those kids out there, you know, screaming in the streets without their families, how are they going to spend the rest of their lives? What's their likely reaction? So if the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu was thinking about trying to de-radicalize them, he's following a policy that I would suspect would be exactly the opposite. And it's the same thing as we talked about last time with respect to supporting a Marxist-Leninist terrorist organization in the heart of a conservative Christian Middle Eastern culture. Right? Which the United States does in the PKK. So these perceptions, this is the way people think. This is the reality that we have to operate in. The damage has been done. The question is whether or not the damage will continue to be done and how debilitating it will be. But I think in this respect, what we're watching in some ways is really the end of this pretense of, you know, American leadership of the world, because we see farther and see broader and have moral superiority and all of this kind of thing. That is being completely laid to waste. So,
well, it was done decades ago when George Bush and the Republicans helped break the Middle East, and it's never recovered.
Yes.
I love listening to you because you always have such great insight and stuff. And one of the themes you've talked about recently is this idea of, you know, we're getting to this weird ideological almost tug of war where people have to, you know, stake your claim and hold on tight, and that's all that matters. And and it's then, you know, distorting the worldview of what's really happening in places like Ukraine and now,
of course,
Gaza. And what's the next steps there? Because, I mean, you seem to have an idea of what people are going to experience, because it's happened, you know, before. Where do people start to turn then for information, and how does that impact your domestically? Because we've got an election coming up next year, and people are trying to say they know what the true worldview is. I mean, where do we go to try to counter that?
Well, I mean, I think you just have to be very alert and read everything with a skeptical eye. I think you have to look at international media outside of the UK, which, you know, are they're just horrific. I think you're seeing a lot of commentators, for example, on YouTube and online, on Twitter, who sort of bring up some of these unpalatable realities. There's lots of people, increasing number of people who do that. you know, you have this reporting by Matt Taibbi and Mike Schellenberger and all these other folks who are, and Margot Cleveland and Julie Kelly and all these other people who are poking holes in this this effort to narrative control that's going on with respect to all these different issues. But to me, and I think you have to read foreign press. You have to understand what people are saying, and you can dismiss it or not, but you have to understand what they're saying. And I think a lack of ability to do that, I mean, not a technological ability, although sometimes, you know, you see things are flooded and hidden and all this kind of shadow banning and all that stuff that goes on. But just in terms of the way it's presented on the surface level in the U.S. media, it almost is a discouragement to go deeper because it's the same reporting, the same way about everything else. I mean, you saw the big debate after the debate between Vivek Ramaswamy and what's her name from CNN. I mean, it was clearly two different people talking in two different worlds.
Right.
And it was clear that the CNN media people just do not have not even contemplated what these things are. And it was the same stuff. It was the same problem with the Russiagate investigations, the same problem with this, the same problem with all of these sorts of things that have been going on. I think that the danger is for the United States, if we think about it, is that a real appreciation of what our interests lie, what our interests are in any particular area of the world, has to start at least with some good, solid, basic understanding of what the actual situation is on the ground. And that's the thing that people need to dig and to find, and they need to read counter arguments, and they need to try to see, maybe this one guy is saying something smart here. He's an idiot over here. I'm sure, you know, some people read my article and say the same thing.
Sure.
But, you know, when I, so when, for example, when I look at American politics and I see all these people screaming about the these demonstrations in favor of the Palestinians or these that have, in some respects, become anti-Semitic, okay, and where people are threatening Jews and all that kind of thing. I mean, I think this is really, when I try to read this without emotion, I look at that, I see this as a, presenting a really interesting problem that's been duplicated in other areas. You know, for example, I mean, what the Bolsheviks wanted to do in Russia was to build on legitimate grievances that people had and then herd them in another direction. What the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, the Marxist-Leninist terrorist organization that the United States supports in Syria under the rubric of the Syrian Democratic Forces, what they're trying to do, of course, is to try to define Kurdishness and what it means to be a Kurd in ways that promotes their own power. Here, in the middle of all this stuff, what you have is a woke industrial complex that is trying to take this legitimate issue of the Palestinian, the plight of the Palestinians, and basically yoke it to their particular cause. And they're trying to do that for in the interest of promoting power. As a matter of fact, I think one of the remedial steps taken by these idiot professors was to broaden their DEI program to include anti-Semitism. So they're going to, they're not going to destroy the edifice. Their machinery is still going to go on. They're just going to try to find ways to now incorporate this new challenge to it and subsume it and swallow it. So
I wouldn't want to disappoint people who are listening for others. They often they report in and listen for others. So I just want to say I don't smoke cigarettes anymore, but if I did, I would have had one when the news came out that the Israel ambassador to the United Nations condemned George Soros for supporting and funding anti-Israel pro-Hamas groups.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, it's phenomenal, isn't it?
Weird. After, it's phenomenal. Weird world we live in.
I would just take a deep lungful and exhale slowly.
Right. That's why this is such a delicious thing if you think about it without, you know, if you try to divest yourself of the emotions and look at it coldly. I mean, as an intellectual problem, it's one that has you've seen in other places.
Yes.
The danger for America is that a legitimate issue become the tool of these wackos. That's the danger for America. You don't want the Bolsheviks to be able to control or be able to profit from the serfs' legitimate grievances. You don't want the communist or Marxist terrorist PKK to become the spokesman of, quote-unquote, the Kurds, particularly if it's abetted by a Western power, which hasn't the foggiest clue about what that means, all right? And what the implications of that are for regional stability in an area where many people are actually serious Muslims. You don't want to say that people cannot be... that anybody who is anti-Zionist is anti-Semitic, because that will take a lot of people who rebel, say, against the idea of Christian Zionism, which actually, as I understand it, precedes regular Zionism, right? Earlier in the 19th century, there are many faith traditions that we know of, which have been very, very skeptical about, to say it mildly, to be very, very skeptical about the theology that is pushing this notion of Christian Zionism. It's almost seen in some respects as an affront to the new covenant, right? That's a theological argument that people can have. They can dispute that. They should not be herded into irrelevance or something else in order to have a particular political party demonstrate its bona fides to a particular group. Okay? So, I mean, I know I've struggled on this on the Kurdish issue, whether the Turkish issue in particular is a Greek Orthodox Christian, right? Nobody wants to hear the other side of the issue. And it's unfortunate, but if you don't listen to the other side of the issue, you're not going to get anywhere. And the irony is that while the Americans on the Greek Turkish issues often get very, very emotional and scream and yell, you know, Mitsotakis was out in, Erdogan visited Mitsotakis in Athens just the other day. So they're trying to get past that stuff themselves. And I think we have to understand why that is. And if you're going to understand why that is, you need to be able to think about that a little bit more broadly. Sorry for that long.
I can only say that the only thing to do now is to put on our no chumbalone caps and pour coffee into our Chicago Way podcast mugs.
I'm looking forward to that.
And adding a little liqueur, like now. I would think some anisette liqueur or cognac in the coffee, just like the streets and sand drivers of old in Chicago. Yeah.
I think a nice coffee, Alexandrian coffee liqueur would be perfect for that. But I digress.
Very good.
But can I just return to one issue, if I may, because it's about the American thing. Clearly, what motivates a lot of young people these days is signing up with these particular protests with respect to Israel, is that they are fed up with the militarization of American policy. Okay, so they are protesting against what they see as establishment equities, in this case being directed at Israel. And that's an important one because Israel and the United States do have this uniquely close relationship. So it's a uniquely sensitive issue, but it's also uniquely powerful and one that uniquely has the ability to draw people out. The challenge is, I think, if I were a Republican strategist, would be to not let anti-Semites and others who have nothing but ill will toward Israel take that cadre of people and make it their own, particularly a Republican Party, which under President Trump emerged in precisely as an antidote to this traditional Republican thing that brought us Iraq, Libya, you name it, Afghanistan, all of these sorts of things. Right. So that's what they, if I were a political strategist, I would work on that. But that's not, and that the bottom line here is, from the United States perspective, and this is where I think Austin is correct, they're trying to help Israel as they see it. And they're pointing this out because it's a very, very concerning thing. And if you want to see Israel succeed and you want it to be strong, You have to, you know, it's incumbent upon the United States, as I wrote, to help it avoid the mistakes that we made in 9/11. And we have not done that. They are making those mistakes. And it's going to be a very, very rough situation down the road unless there's some course correction.
Nick Cass, Jeff and I hope that you'll come back and also write again for JohnCassNews.com because, you know, I'm getting some great writers are signing up. You're one of them, obviously.
Well, thank you,
we have, you know, excellent writers and got a new one, Dan Proft.
Excellent. Finally, huh?
Writing about the criminal injustice of the Cook County property tax system.
Fantastic.
Saying there are no victims of the system. And I just want everyone to read it, and I want to see you again, and I guess we'll see each other soon, right, at Christmas at my house.
Indeed, we will, and looking forward to... you know, if I can find any more intel on dibs here and how it's practiced in Romania and the eastern reaches of the Balkans, northeastern Balkans, I'll be happy to see if I can find that out for you.
The problem is, of course, getting everyone together at the same time and driving all over the place. And
I know
that you have obligations, but my obligations are to you and to my Cass onion soup, and I'm not going to, I'm going to do it right, and I'm going to do it properly.
I've told you this before, but every time we go to anywhere where they serve French onion soup, I don't care where it is in Europe. It could be, we'll do it in Paris too someday.
Right.
My son Nico always says, you know, let's get the French onion soup, and then the first words he'll say is, this is not as good as Theo John's, okay? So just
wise,
to let you know.
Wise young men.
To let you know, yeah.
For Nick Cass, Nicholas Cass. What is the title now? I just have to redo it, Jeff, if you don't mind. What's your title now at Alexandrian Group?
Executive Director for International Corporate Affairs at Alexandrian and Senior Fellow for European Affairs at the Center for the National Interest in Washington, D.C.
That sounds pretty good. And for Jeff Carlin, Executive Producer, WGN Radio, my friend, starring on that coffee mug, the brilliant coffee mug, the Chicago Way trademark coffee mug. Yeah, eat your heart out, little jealous creature. And for me, John Cass, Editor-in-Chief of John Cass News, your place for a great hat, great coffee, and great common sense. Join us again, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Way Podcast on WGN+.